Welcome to Everything Belongs, a podcast for those living, creating, leading, and thriving while in the deep end of life. I'm your host, Madison Morgan, leadership coach, creative consultant, and speaker. I coach soulful visionaries and go-getting mavericks who desire to create art of their lives and take their work both deeper and higher. In this show, I'll be bringing you an overflow of conversations with my favorite thought leaders, teachers, healers, and creatives who inspire me to live more fully in my own power, worth, and wholeness, along with offering some episodes where I share my own practical insights, behind-the-scenes peeks into my process, and tools I use on my own journey. There will not be much we shy away from here because at this table, everything belongs. Therefore, you can expect me to ask the uncomfortable, juicy questions. You can expect that you'll hear people you disagree with on the podcast and maybe even ideas you've never previously considered. I trust you with your own discernment as we take this deep dive. You can expect to laugh, cry, learn, and be challenged by the guests as they share their diverse experiences and views of the world. It's my hope through learning to see that all of it belongs that you will develop a more sovereign way of holding yourself so you can playfully go after the life, relationships, and career you are made for, to let all parts of yourself have a seat at the table, to lead and create from your deepest truth and become your own source of validation, all because you finally know you're worthy of it. All that's required to get started, that you show up curious and willing. Let's dive in. Hey everybody, I'm so happy to be back with you with a really brilliant and beautiful podcast interview today. We have been navigating the last couple weeks doing the solo episodes that I'm now calling microdoses, and I've been having so much fun with that. It has truly been such a joy to be able to self-express and to share what I feel might be of service to you and to be a little bit more in my own integrity about who I'm bringing on the show. You know, I get a lot of requests to be on the show, and there's a lot of people who are brilliant and amazing, but don't necessarily serve you the best way that I would want to. And so I'm really committed here forward to bringing on even more aligned podcast guests and people who really light me up. And today's guest is certainly someone that I am lit up by. He actually is someone I'm choosing to learn from in the next 6 weeks in his course. His name is Luis Mojica. He is a somatic therapist and a nutritionist. And I discovered him via James Olivia, who's actually been on the podcast, one of the very first episodes we ever recorded for the podcast. And anyone who is a friend of James Olivia is someone that I want to check out their work because James Olivia has such a wonderful group of people that they learn from. So when I checked out Luis's Instagram, I was immediately captured by the clear and kind way he speaks about trauma and learning to release our trauma by relating to it. So like I said, Luis is a somatic therapist and a nutritionist whose work specifically explores healing stress and trauma holistically. His entire body of work, Holistic Life Navigation, was modeled after his own journey of healing, his chronic illness, and PTSD, which he shares a little bit in today's episode. His podcast is truly a gem. So if you liked this episode today, or if you liked the episode, please go check out his podcast and his work. Today, what we are really going to be talking about is the fawning response. And if you've been following my work for a while, you know that boundary work, sovereignty work, belonging to myself, and teaching my clients to self-belong and relate from a place of their inner wholeness is so central in my work. And as I've learned over the years, people-pleasing is actually a trauma response. It's the fawn response. And so if you're someone who struggles to speak their truth, if you appease or lie or even just meet other people's needs before you're aware of your own, this is the episode for you. I loved exploring Luis's take on the fawning response and how we heal from it. And he also goes into such a kind and compassionate way of understanding trauma responses in general and relating to them with ease. You know, there's a lot of information out there right now about trauma. And yes, all of us have trauma, but I felt Luis's work was super approachable, super human, and although very intellectual and smart, super approachable and real. So I hope you enjoy today's episode with Luis And before we dive into the show, I just want to give you a quick reminder about Serve It Up, my business mastermind program. And I wanted to, you know, say thank you to all of you who were so interested and joined. We were filling to the brim. We actually added an extra seat in the current intake because it sold out so quickly. And we are now pre-enrolling for the fall. And we're pre-enrolling because basically it's filling up quickly already. And we wanted to make sure you got an early bird price up until May 30th before a price increase. So if you're listening to this in real time, please go to madisonmorrigan.com/serveitup if you're curious about the details of the program and if you're curious to have a one-on-one conversation with me and see if it's really a good fit. We're going to be starting the fall intake in September of 2022, and there are limited seats and they're already filling. So if you want to be mentored by me in your leadership, in your business, in your systems, and get the support from not just me, but a group of 13 folks who will be learning alongside you, please lean into this. I don't teach business anywhere else. I am so delighted at the amount of you who were taken by this and wanted to join me in Serve It Up. So the fall program will be probably filling up before we even officially launch it in the fall. So go do that. And I'm just so excited for you to hear from Luis today. So let's dive into today's episode. Luis, thank you again for coming on Everything Belongs. As I shared with you privately before we hit record, I found you through James Olivia, who the audience is going to know. And so just with that reference point, I think people can probably already gather this is going to be a really fun and juicy, deep conversation. The reason why I reached out is I listened to your episode on fawning on your podcast, and I felt like you were explaining and walking through my lived experience in a way that was so articulate, so like I'd never heard anyone describe it quite like that. You know, we hear people pleasing, we hear fawning, acquiescing, but the language you used, the science, and then the body-based information you used felt like so human. So I'm excited to have this conversation. And I would love if a random person stopped you on the street and said, like, what do you do? How would you define this to them?
I sit with people and teach them how to listen to their bodies. That's really what it is that I do.
Yeah. Can you tell us how you got into this work, how you found this work?
Yeah, I found this work from the need myself, right? So I spent many years, you know, dealing with a lot of PTSD and trauma and insomnia and physical illness, and probably someone would call it mental illness, and just felt very hopeless. And a couple of things organically happened in my life that started shifting me out of that hopelessness. Music was one of them. The earth was another, a connection to the earth. Food, eating differently. So many things were just kind of like spontaneously happening. But it wasn't until I had this sudden recollection of traumatic events that I had blocked out when I was in my 20s that just terrified me. Like I couldn't believe they were my memories. And I felt them so viscerally, but I kept seeing them and I was just completely back there, like everything we hear about when we think of a flashback or a PTSD event. And it was so arresting. I felt really paranoid. I didn't want to go out of the house. I didn't want to work with my clients. I had like a full-time nutrition practice. I was just kind of feeling very low capacity. I just became a father. So all these things in my life had shifted and were taking a lot of energy. And then all these flashbacks emerged. So I went from one therapist to the other. And the more therapy I did, the worse I was getting, because I was just gathering these new identities. And nothing wrong with identity, but for me, each one that I was gathering was just kind of like fixing me in that state of what had happened. It wasn't showing me where I was now. And so I don't even remember how it happened, but somehow I found this woman who was an art therapist and a somatic therapist. And I never heard the word somatic in my life, but when I heard it, something in my body was saying, "Ooh, that's what you want. Go there." And I remember sitting with her in the session and her asking me, you know, what I was there for, me telling her about the flashbacks, and then her interrupting me and saying, "Wait, where are you feeling that in your body as you're telling me?" And just that pivot from my story and my identity into what did my body feel changed my life. And in a couple sessions, things started releasing from me and reworking that had been there for decades that I had no idea how to even connect to. And I knew at that point that I had to get trained in this and start teaching other people.
Your story of things kind of shedding away and just all the symptoms, you know, there are people who might be listening to this. I'm just thinking like it can feel very sometimes upsetting to hear that someone just started doing trauma work and all their symptoms fell away, because I know people have been doing lots of work, taking care of their bodies, eating, like you were in nutrition, you knew how to take care of your body, you were doing therapy. And I was one of those people also. And I know a lot of people who are those people too, who are taking so much responsibility for their health and their body and their life. And it's like, things are getting worse. Now with the education you have, like, why do you think that is?
It's such a good question. And I love that you're saying that, because it's good for people to hear that I was doing like 11 years of deep holistic self-work, right? And on one hand, I was getting better, like my biology was changing. So a lot of my autoimmune disorders were healing, you know, things on the level of like symptom and expressions of skin rashes and things like that. Those were all healing and I was great. So on the surface, it's like, oh, this is working. You know, I'm doing good. But there was still this like deep dissociation happening where I couldn't quite be in my experiences all the time. And I would get triggered really easily, or I would have like a... I would feel like I was getting a fever before I was going to go out to a social event, and then I would cancel and then I'd feel fine 2 seconds later. So I had a lot of anxiety around being seen and talking to people. And it isn't until now that I've understood that when we have trauma, I guess the first place to start with is trauma isn't the event, it's the body's response to the event. So I had a lot of traumatic events from like age 2 to age 15, we could say, like many, many one after the other. And like a lot of us, and we would call it developmental trauma, childhood developmental trauma, which means as your nervous system is forming, you're being hit with these huge, overwhelming amounts of electricity and charge and adrenaline. That electricity, charge, and adrenaline, that's physical, it's biological, it's a hormonal chemistry in the body that turns into a physical constriction within the organs, within the posture, within the muscles and the tissues. So trauma is a very biological event. And again, it's in response to the event itself. So the threat occurs, my body has that biology of response, and then the threat is long over for decades, but the response never quite releases. So we stay in this biology of threat for, I mean, most of our lives until we even are told there's such a thing as a biology of threat. So for me, the missing puzzle piece was just that trauma, stress, anxiety, PTSD, it's a biology. It's not a state of mind. And understanding it was a biology meant there was an actual physical presence in me that I was able to connect with and learn how to release and relate to. And that was so much different than psychoanalyzing my experiences, identifying with my experiences, kind of just holding it in this mental container while the body was just like begging for help.
I so appreciate you naming that it's a biological experience. I was very fortunate personally. The first therapist I had was an energetic practitioner of something called Splunkna, which is just a Christian excuse to do energetic work. It was like, you know, they just said Jesus and prayed, and also it was energetic work. And so I was really grateful to find someone who did that work. And within months, my acne was cleared. Like the religion itself no longer connected with me. Like so many things just shifted. And then I got so curious. I kind of got sucked into my head, and things persisted in a way. And I tend to work with a lot of extremely intelligent people, people who are really smart. They've done all the research. And that's almost why it's so frustrating to be able to explain in and out what your patterns are and why you're doing what you do, but you're still doing them. Which that's in my experience, yeah, it's like, it feels more disassociative in a way. It's like, now I know everything about this, but I can't feel anything about this.
What you just said is like the gold. I just wanted to kind of reflect that, you know, like I know and even understand and can name all this, but I can't feel all this. Mm-hmm. It's literally a way to bypass the feeling. It's like a coping response.
Yeah. I'm so curious about your relationship with your own body. I've heard you talk about the body as its own organism, its own animal. And I'm curious how, maybe even backing all the way up to the cultural context in which you were raised, how you were taught to relate to your body, and then what shifted after this process.
Absolutely. You know, I've come to think that my whole life just led to doing this work, because when I think of the body I was born into, it was such a unique experience and not many people on this planet experience. And so there's a condition, I call it more of an expression called intersex. And there's like, it's an umbrella term for a lot of different expressions. Essentially what it means is the body produces two forms of chromosomes and or hormones that makes you biologically both sexes, right? For some people, it manifests with their genitalia, their internal reproductive organs. Others, it's just a chromosome, like nothing ever expresses. Others, it's hormones. So I had the latter. So I was born with the estrogenic expression, where my body made a ton of estrogen, more than even little biological girls will make when they're born. So as I was developing, I started developing breasts and I started developing hips. And so I went through this like strange partial female puberty that none of my male friends were going through. And there was no name for it. The late 80s, early 90s, there was no awareness of gender fluidity, of intersexuality. There was no non-binary, like there were no terms in popular culture to even celebrate this. So it became like a dysfunction and it became a deformity, really. That's how it was internalized. And the doctors would keep saying, oh, you're going to grow out of it. Like once you hit a normal male puberty, this will just all go away. And so I remember waiting and waiting and waiting for this male puberty to come. And like 4 years later, it finally came and my breasts continued to grow. And I became anorexic. I tried to do everything I could do to lose these breasts because they were the source of so much trauma, bullying and assault and constant harassment by every peer I could imagine. You know, that was like essentially like a straight guy that was kind of afraid of their own femininity. So what's so interesting about my experience is like, I got to experience misogyny in a male body, which is very strange. And those early, you know, to an extent, obviously, and those early years of, because I have two breasts on my chest and my hips are a little wider and I'm like more feminine in nature, especially when I was 10 and 11, just because of that, I was a threat and I was a target. It's so interesting because, I did everything in my power to not relate to my body because I internalized that this body, I internalized everything I was being told by everybody. Your body's disgusting. You know, you're a creature. Like now I love being a creature, but at the time it's like the worst thing you could hear when you're 11 years old and you're going through puberty. And I internalized this extreme shame over this really unique body, which wasn't even being addressed in culture. Like there were no magazines, there was nowhere to even see a body that looked like mine. So I made a decision really young to just shut it down, not to feel from the neck down. I designed like a style, like two shirts, a tank top, a vest, a sweater, you know, all these things to hide that I had breasts. Eventually people forgot, you know, as years went on, they just forgot that I had them. So I became safe and I stopped being harassed. I stopped being bullied. At the extent of also losing complete connection and resonance with my own body. So I became so disembodied for survival. And I would binge eat to kind of like press down the charge that came up because my body was so afraid of being seen. And then when I was 21, I had top surgery. And I thought, I'm going to be healed. Like once these are gone, nothing can touch me. And that was the biggest mind bend was, I appeared as a totally normal cisgender biological man. No one would know unless they really looked at my hips, but no one would know. And I was so skinny at the time too, to try to make sure there was no fat on my hips to show anything extra. And still, my shoulders would always be hunching as if I was still hiding breasts for years. I would get frequent migraines. If someone came to give me a hug and it pressed against my chest, there'd be a wince. So my body had stored all the trauma responses. even though the actual breasts and the events were long gone. So coming from good 12 years of dissociating from my body, hating my body, living a life that did everything in its power to keep people and myself from my body, then to actually learn I have to go into my body to heal my trauma, it was so powerful. And so I'm just so grateful for that work, because it's taught me that it's not about getting rid of something. It's about integrating. Again, like visually, I even started modeling at one point. Like I tried to prove to myself, like, you're a normal guy, no one will know. And nothing I did made me feel better inside until I started working with the trauma.
I feel so much tenderness in my heart as you share this. And thank you for sharing. I think about, you know, this audience is predominantly women, not all women. But I think I've heard so many stories from women about growing breasts and the unwanted attention that that brings people with breasts. And just even if nothing horrific happened in the typical sense, mm-hmm. we think, you know, as we say, capital T trauma, these ways that we contort ourselves to disconnect from the attention, the being seen, the whatever it is, it's just really, I related having a very different experience being in a body. And so I just really thank you for sharing that. And I actually have to sit with it for a second, because I was like feeling really, really tender as you were talking about it and thinking about how many people have told me about their experience of having breasts, particularly large-breasted people, about the attention and how that's caused such a distortion. And also the amount of queer people who are obviously queer that I've talked to who feel that being in their body is inherently threatening. Even if there hasn't been, again, this like big, big, big thing that people would think is that's the thing that you're allowed to have trauma about.
Yes. See, what you're touching on right there is so important, because what it really helped me, because I never identified any of this as trauma. I was sexually assaulted. I didn't identify that as trauma. Because for me, when I grew up, probably similar to what you're remembering, trauma was if you went to war.
Right.
Right. Trauma was like a massive car accident that you almost died in. Like that was trauma. Everything else was just like inconvenient. And, you know, and so it was interesting because I've had so many clients who are in biological female bodies who have said, my breasts started coming in and suddenly all the attention I got felt so threatening. They weren't sexual creatures yet. Like the body was doing something before the mind was ready. You know, a lot happens during development and our culture doesn't know how to hold that. We lost those rituals. So there's mm-hmm. a lot of trauma around that. Mm-hmm. And what you're saying is so important, because the way we classify trauma somatically is actual or perceived threat. And the second one, the perceived threat, that's what really opened my body up to healing. Because I realized, wow, like I've actually had trauma, like threatening experiences, and I've had a ton of non-threatening experiences that were registered as threat, and I'm traumatized from them.
Yeah.
Right. And so a lot of people are misdiagnosed into certain kind of like psychoses, into being told that they have general anxiety disorder, when really they have unprocessed trauma because they don't even know they have it.
Mm-hmm. I really, really resonate. I was on a long journey seeking neurodivergent diagnosis, which I've not received. However, the overlap between the way my trauma has shown up in my life really looks a lot like autism. And that has been quite an interesting thing. My father actually is autistic. And so I'm like so similar to him, but the things that I've experienced just have caused me to relate to people in a way that's like distant and observant, as opposed to actually being in the moment. And I actually want to transition to talking about fawning, because my experience was either I'm extremely disconnected from the event altogether, or I'm completely enmeshed and I have no autonomy or control over my body at all. So I'm either completely acquiescing or I'm completely disconnected. And I know this is particularly for those who are socialized as girls, this is a very common experience, because we're taught it's actually safer, that the perceived threat is mitigated or the real threat is mitigated if I can be pleasing, if I can do something that would mitigate that threat. And that has caused a lot of people that I know, including myself, sexual trauma, relational trauma, like, and the feeling of there's no one to blame but me because I'm the one self-abandoning and I don't know how to stop. And so whenever I heard your podcast again on fawning, I was like, holy shit, it was such a compassionate lens. I would love, I mean, yes, your own experience. And I would love if you could just talk through like, what is the fawn response? Cause we normally hear fight or flight.
Yep. You got it. So what's great about that is fawn response, first of all, is a trauma response. So when we hear people pleaser, when we hear acquiescing, even when we hear fawning, some people think it's a choice, like it's a personality type. Has zero to do with your personality, has zero to do with your choice. Just like any other trauma response, it's reflexive. So trauma responses happen automatically. We don't ask them to come. We don't turn them on. They turn on inside of us. They express and then they stop. Fawning is so unique because as a trauma response, it's socially engaging. Whereas fight, flight, and freeze aren't about engaging. It's about fighting, running away, or shutting down. Whereas fawning is engaging. So it appears like someone is consenting. It appears like someone is actually enjoying this connection and actually like asking for more. Because that's what we do when we're fawning. We're trying to mollify the other person's body and behavior by giving them what they want. And it's so, the roots of it are so deep. Like you said, like women who are socially conditioned, I tend to find like in general, any feminine expression will fall into this. So like queer boys, intersex boys, trans people, though, anyone that has like that femininity mixed in with any kind of masculinity, they'll find the fawn response to be the way they survive dominant masculine culture. Cause it's been conditioned and overcoupled that femininity is subservient. It's not by nature, but it's been conditioned that way. So when we're fawning, the first thing we want to remember is our bodies feel other bodies. And so at a very early age, we learn that our bodies sometimes can tell when someone's going to blow up or do something dysregulating. And then we learn if I say or do this thing, it kind of calms them down for a moment, or I get rewarded for it. Or they tell me they love me because of it. And biologically, that gives us a really nice dopamine hit. Like it feels secure in our body. And it actually temporarily regulates and soothes our nervous systems. So these trauma responses like fawning, they have biological means. Like there's a really sophisticated reason why I would fawn with you. Because if I'm not, I haven't learned the capacity or that it's safe to be authentic. The fawner has a nervous system that says your expressions are dangerous, right? Especially your true expressions are dangerous. So it really comes down to what's honest for you. And this is especially true if it's like controversial or you're disagreeing with somebody, that will equal a threat. Now, the threat could be actual threat to your life. It could be threat to your security, like a parent that won't talk to you if you disagree with them when you're like 8 years old. And then you learn, I lose my secure attachment if I disagree. I'm going to stop disagreeing. Now, the body is saying that. We are not consciously in our bedrooms like plotting this out at 8 years old. The nervous system is, and it's reflexive and unconscious. So everyone listening, when you're going into people pleasing or you identify with being a people pleaser, again, it's not your personality. It's your biology. Your body has learned to reflexively please the person in front of you because it feels safer.
I think that feels so much more compassionate. You know, whenever I first started uncovering boundary issues, you know, 10 years ago, I was like, oh, I had stories like, I'm just not good at picking people. I'm just not good at boundaries. And I had all these self-blaming stories that were like therapeutic-ish. Like I was learning in like self-help therapeutic context, but we're still a lot of like, okay, well, I'll just learn to be different and behave different so this doesn't happen. And I've kind of found that like a lot of my self-helping was actually a different fawn response of I'll just change myself to be more pleasing. So, and because people pleasing is not so pleasing. So I'm going to stop doing that, but still feel the charge in my body around how it feels. It just, I'm going to modify my behavior, which is so much energy and self-management and like not an authentic expression of self. Mm-hmm. And I think what feels really compassionate about it being a biological response that I'm not choosing is I thought I was intentionally being fake.
Yes.
And I saw that as a character flaw and was working so hard to be more authentic. My body didn't want to be honest. And so I would be able to be completely honest alone. And thank goodness for the internet, because I was like, that was my first safe place to authentically express, because there was enough distance between, you know, myself and whoever was reading it that I wasn't anticipating response. Mm-hmm. Not everyone has that experience, but it was true for me. And it's been almost a working my way back into my life from the most public, which felt the most safe. And I know that's not everyone's experience, but it was easier for me to publish something on the internet that felt true than it was to tell, you know, my ex-husband that how I really felt about him. And yeah. I had so much self-judgment. And so as I'm learning more and more about fawning and trauma, it as a biological response and an adaptation, couldn't get that out. It feels relieving. And I'm wanting to know, particularly around how fawning relates to sexual trauma, because when I heard you talk about this and the nuance between assault and sexual trauma that has its roots in fawning, it felt really liberating and also like edgy.
Mm, super edgy.
Yeah. Like, honestly, you picked that up.
Thank you. It can be really controversial and confusing. And I just wanted to respond when you were saying about, you know, the compassionate lens. I couldn't agree more. Like, that's what the somatic lens of trauma has gifted me and all of us to learn it, is the body's doing it. And so it's like, how do I get to relate to that versus identify with it? And Resmaa Menakem is one of my favorite authors, and he teaches a lot about like racialized cultural trauma through the lens of somatics. And one thing that he says is decontextualized trauma in a person looks like personality. So when you don't know you have trauma, all of these behaviors and responses look like something, again, that you're consenting to, something you want. So we really shame ourselves and go into a spiral of even self-hate and blame when it's something our body is doing, like a sneeze that we don't have much control over until we start relating to it. It was mind-blowing for me to understand and really, I don't know, discover or uncover this nuance between like sexual assault and trauma from sexual fawning, because sexual assault, it goes without saying, is a highly traumatic event. Then there's these sexual fawning experiences where the line gets blurred for so many of us. When we are in the realm of people pleasing, and we'll use the word fawning just for the purposes of this work we're doing, when we are fawning, it becomes a reflexive behavior. So that means that the primary way we relate to others is through the fawning mechanism. When we are actively fawning, we're also a bit disembodied. We're not fully in the body. We're not fully associated. We're slightly dissociated. And there's some freeze going on. So there isn't 100% agency. Now, what makes this highly nuanced is we can become sexually traumatized by a consensual sexual experience with our partner of 15 years if it's coming from the fawn. Right? The fawn behavior, because it means I'm reflexively having sex or doing something sexual with my partner to make them happy. My body doesn't want to, not even because of them. My body just doesn't want to. And I'm bypassing that because of the fawn mechanism. Or I should even be more clear. My body's bypassing that for the fawn mechanism. It's not my choice. I'm unaware of this reflex. So I've worked with so many people who have been in long-term glorious relationships and have a shit ton of sexual trauma in their bodies from sexually fawning. And this, where it gets really edgy, is in the realm of like, I went on a date with somebody and then we went home and slept together. I didn't actually like it. Well, why'd you go home with them? Why'd you smile when you didn't want to? Why'd you say yes when you meant no? This is where the nuance of trauma has to also come in, when we're like, actually holding space for people who have either assault or attempted or even have a really traumatic sexual experience that was consensual for the most part. We have to understand if the fawning mechanism is all about consenting when we don't want to, then we're actually out there shaking our head yes, flirting, moving our body in certain ways, even allowing penetration and actual intercourse and connection to happen when deep inside we don't want it, but our body's reflexively doing it. And that was me. Like, I lived that way for years and years and years. And so it's we see it manifest much more easily, I think, socially in women. I've met a lot of men who do it too and haven't noticed until they went into their bodies. So I'm curious if that makes sense or what you're hearing there.
It makes so much sense. And a lot of folks I know, again, including myself, I'm like, everything I'm saying here is like me included, because this is the dominant way that my body has learned to survive. And so myself and a lot of people have really, you know, behind closed doors, asked questions about things that felt like potentially rape, that where it's like, I don't want to say this because I don't want to open up the door that this could be possible for things that need to be taken as that. And that's, I think, the caution, at least I've experienced around talking about this publicly, is the sexual assaults that I've experienced aren't assaults, because they were predominantly the sexual trauma I've experienced, might be a better way of saying it, weren't assaults. They were a fawning response that traumatized me. And it's very, very common. And also sexual assault happens.
That's right.
And I just want to make sure that people hear me say that, because it definitely does happen, but the nuances of what your body is doing is different. It could be the same, but what the other person's doing might be different.
That's the piece what you just said right there.
Yeah.
Because sexual fawning is like at its core is actually for assault. You know, that your body goes along with it so you can survive. So the person doesn't get aggravated. And this can be triggering for those of you listening. I totally understand that. But I'm saying this so we can like not shame ourselves for when we go into these situations or we find ourselves in these. And we're like, why didn't I scream? That's why. Because your body went into a reflexive strategy to help you survive the event. So sexual fawning is inherently traumatic, but it's not always in response to assault. And that's the gray area. It's exactly how you said it.
Yeah. Like you said, with a partner who's loving and trusting, and it's a consensual experience, and sexual fawning occurred and trauma happened because of, as that's a result.
That's exactly right.
Can you share what happens in the body when this is happening? I think understanding what is happening on a biological level can be really compassion inducing.
I agree. You mean when fawning is occurring?
When fawning is occurring. Yeah.
Yeah. So one thing we want to think about again is the nervous system. It runs through our whole body. And when we have what I call the charge or activation, that's when our body's stimulated in response to perceived, again, or actual threat. So if we have like, we call it overcoupling, when the body associates something threatening with something else. If my overcoupling is being seen as scary, right? Or being seen will hurt me, which was mine for many years. When I'm with human beings, not anymore, but when I'm with human beings for a long time, my nervous system would start to get activated. And activation means my adrenals are turning on. Now, the moment my adrenals turn on and I have adrenaline coursing through my blood, my body chooses one of those four responses. They're fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. So in this case, my body chooses fawn. And it literally, it's like you have to think of it visually as a puppeteer, and you're a puppet. This energy, this force of life comes over the body and it moves it. We are literally nodding and laughing when things aren't funny. We're laughing when someone like offends us or says something mean to us. Someone cuts us off and go, oh, sorry. And they're the one that cut us off. I see that a lot. Like, you know, if I watch people hosting interviews, like especially on the news, you'll see this with anchor women in particular, apologizing when someone cuts them off. The body just reflexively says, I'm fine. You did nothing wrong. Because it's trying to show the other person that everything's okay, because it's trying to mollify the other person. So the nervous system is literally moving you to nod, to smile. For me, it would like move my hips and open my body, and I'd become very sexual with people. And I wasn't even turned on. And I was like, why does everybody like me? I never understood it, because my body was saying, come to me. I like you. I want to be with you. So it's a physical, actual expression and a gestural expression and social. And it's engaging. The body itself is engaging with the other bodies and trying to tell the other bodies, I want whatever you're doing so you are happy. And that's like physically, biologically, what's actually happening in the system when this turns on. And then what also makes it nuanced is the part of us that doesn't want it, that part's frozen. So with fawn, there's always a bit of a freeze attached to it. The part of me that wants to leave the grocery store and not have the conversation, that part's frozen in place. The part of me that wants to say no, someone says, will you help me move things from my house on Saturday morning? And I want to say no. I say, oh, of course I will. I love helping you, even though I don't. That part of me that doesn't is frozen. So there's a freeze that, you know, is in conjunction with the phone.
I'm just imagining myself as a waitress in my early 20s, stuck at a table that I cannot leave. And all my other tables are like pissed that I'm, you know, not doing a good job with them, but I can't, I'm like, it felt like I would be frozen pleasing this person, whoever was talking to me. And I was like, I have to get the money and the whole thing. But like, I wouldn't really realize how frozen I was until I felt like they released me. Like it was up to them to release me from the situation. Mm-hmm. And my friends and I, who I met waitressing, always joke about how I was a great server to the one table I would get stuck at. but to all the other
You're probably
other
the
tables,
best one at that one table.
Yes, the one table, and everyone else I'm just neglecting completely because I, in that moment, have forgotten they exist, or it's like spiraling in the back, but here I am so present with this person. Oh my goodness. So I want to shift the conversation to what happens when we heal, because I think really knowing that we can heal and that the body wants to heal is really important. And so I'm wondering if you could give us a felt sense of what connection and wanting to be present to connection feels like when it's not a fawn response.
So the first thing that comes up with that is the word capacity. So when we are in a trauma response, it's because we don't have the capacity for the situation. So if I'm fawning, it's because the discomfort, the hit of sensation I would get in my body from making somebody uncomfortable by disagreeing, by walking away, by saying, sorry, I can't help you on Saturday. So uncomfortable or disappointed, the sensational overload of my nervous system in response to that, I don't have capacity for. So to avoid feeling that sensation of disappointment, I fawn. So the way we start to heal the fawning mechanism or reflex is we start noticing to feel our capacity and feel what that feels like and what that means on a biological level. So anyone following can actually drop in. It's like a 1 minute check-in we can do together. And if we just notice our bodies right now, there's kind of these three categories I've found, and it's numbness, constriction, and expansion. Each of them have a lot of nuance. So expansion would be like peacefulness, ease, softness, pleasure. That'd be expansion. So everyone takes a breath and just notices where in our bodies can we feel a bit of ease, a bit of calm, some openness, a place that just feels nice to be in. And it can be a large part of the body. It can be your thumb, it can be your ear, it can be any part. That feeling of ease, that's what it feels like to have some capacity. It's a part of us that's open. So charge and sensation gets to move right through. Now we check in with the part that's constricted. What part feels tense or clamped down or pressure or stress? And as people listening do this, they may notice like all of me, or they might notice, you know, my chest or my jaw. That tends to be where a lot of us keep it, stomach. But just noticing that constriction, that clamping, it's like the body's defense. It's the body saying, no, nothing's allowed in. Sensation cannot come through. Depending on how much constriction we have in our body, that points us to what our capacity is for charge. So when charge comes through, how much space do we actually have in our system to even let the charge move? Or if we're so constricted, the charge comes in and gets stuck and we get overwhelmed, right? If you're frozen or you're numb, it's like you can't even feel the sensation in certain parts of you. It's like, oh, I didn't even feel my legs until I looked at them. That tells us the body's beyond overwhelm. It's beyond capacity. So we first have to start by just identifying these parts of us, which shift throughout the day and the weeks and the years based on a lot of different things. And then as we start building our capacity through different somatic techniques, we have more of an openness in us. So then when I go to the store and I run into that person that always talks and I don't want to say like, sorry, I have to go, I feel the rush that wants me to say, sorry, I have to go. And because I have this expanded capacity, I breathe into that rush and I'm just allowed to say, sorry, I have to go. Versus if I was really constricted with low capacity, that rush of my truth would come in and it would get so overwhelmed because there wouldn't be a lot of room for it, that my body would reflexively respond by fawning because it can't handle the sensation of disappointment. Does that make sense?
It makes so much sense. And I've just been in the last couple of days thinking about the body as an electrical being. And so it's really fun that you're using this language as kind of like conduit of electricity. And that also takes the judgment out of it. It's just like, oh, well, low capacity isn't a sign of being a bad person, which in the self-help world, and those especially in my community who come from post high control religious environments, there can be an overcoupling of low capacity or not having the skill to feel regulated with sin or with I'm bad or wrong. And it feels like a shifting away from that idea that there could be a good or bad here, as opposed to just, do I have capacity to move this energy through?
That's
going to change if you're a person who cycles, if you're a person who cycles literally every year, because we all do, you know, it's going to change, and that's not wrong, but just knowing what the capacity is seems that it supports and not fully going into a response that's a habitual response.
That's the piece that's really important, understanding that when we really see these things through the lens of biology and capacity, we lose identity and then we lose all that shame. And you're absolutely right. In the self-help world, in the spiritual world, it's almost like we use capacity as something that's conditional. Like, how well am I doing is based on my capacity. I'm not good, or I haven't worked hard enough, or I'm self-sabotaging. When really it's a form of nature to have different levels of capacity. And in this like post-colonial dominant culture, we've successfully been severed from our sensations of our body the same way we've been removed from our connection to the earth. So part of this work is really inherently decolonial as far as the body's concerned, not land rights yet, but the body, because we're able to go in and say, oh, I was taught not to feel you, but I'm going to actually feel you again and see you through an animist lens of this body isn't me. It's an animal. It's a creature. It's a being that I get to be in relationship with. And it's telling me it has low capacity today. And then just by listening to that, you might take a nap. Whereas before you'd push through and answer emails, right? And so that listening to capacity is also a very natural way that we build capacity. And then trauma response also starts to dissolve naturally because we built that.
I would love for you to the best of your ability, define decolonizing for those who are like, heard of that, don't really understand what that means in the context of this conversation at all.
Absolutely. So the actual term, let's say the decolonizing in the world would literally be giving land back to people whose treaties were broken. That's what actual decolonizing is. The colony leaves the land that it was dominating. Decolonizing the body is something that's an individual somatic practice where you're checking in with your own body to see how have I inherited through my lineage? How have I, by growing up in this culture, how have I inherited and taken on the dominant expressions from colonization? We live in a country, you and I don't know how many people listening are in America, but in America, we are founded on dominance. We dominated a land and another culture to create ours. We didn't, but our ancestors did. And my ancestors, I have on both sides. I had the ones that were colonized and I had the ones that probably did some colonizing. What matters for us is we come from that dominance, and that's a trauma response too. It's really a fight response. And so being bathed in a culture that really prides itself on fighting and really thinks like taking over and dominating other countries even and cultures is like the way, we internalize that in our own bodies. So the same way a European came and conquered and dominated and colonized what was Turtle Island, now North America, we do that with our bodies. We feel a sensation and we say, be quiet, and we drink coffee. You know, we feel a pain and we say, I'm going to watch TV instead. Something comes up to be related to and we suppress it in us. So then in the world, if it comes up through someone else, we suppress it in them. So decolonizing the body is really about figuring out, by going into your soma, identifying what you've adopted without even realizing it from colonization hundreds of years ago that's still upheld, and slowly letting yourself deconstruct that. And I just wanted to say my colleague, Amber McSeal, her work is called Decolonizing the Psyche. And she really introduced this concept to me through Psyche and Soma. So I always like dropping her name so people can go to her website and check out her work. And it's Decolonizing the Psyche.
Beautiful. I'll put her work and Resumenikin in the show notes. So anyone who's just looking for more, and also your podcast, of course, so people can find the references here. What you said about what I dominate in myself, I'm going to dominate in others. I just got chills because I certainly see that as true, is what I find intolerable about myself. You know, of course I find intolerable about other people, the people who trigger me most. I'm like, oh, turns out we're quite similar. It turns out there's something about them that is resonant. The latest one is earnestness. I'm like really learning to accept my earnestness. And I'm like, oh God, that's why I'm like, just really learning about tenderheartedness over here. It's,
I love that.
It's a whole thing. Well, I feel like I could spend so much more time chatting with you, picking your brain, getting to know you. But in the terms of this context and this conversation of fawning, is there anything that you didn't get to say that feels really important before we wrap up?
I think I just want to keep reiterating that you're not the fawning mechanism. Like, I really want people to see it as a sneeze, or as a yawn, you know? Yeah. It's like a burp. Like yeah. Your body does these reflexive things all the time and we don't identify with them. Mm-hmm. Because fawning is so socially engaging, we do think it's what we desire, but mm-hmm. it's just a mechanism that we've grown up with.
I love that. Are you ready for some rapid fire?
I believe I am.
Okay,
we'll
cool.
See how good I am.
We'll see. That. We have 10 spacious minutes for you to answer these five That's questions. Good. So I think we'll be good. Yeah, we'll be good. Okay. What are you most enjoying learning right now?
I would say I hold space for groups that do decolonizing their bodies, you know, work in that. And I learn so much through everything they talk about. And I think right now I'm really into the whole decolonizing the land around you. So noticing how wild you allow your land to be versus how much you garden and groom it and how that literally speaks to the wildlife when you allow it to be its indigenous self. So That's right now really lighting me up.
Cool. I have questions, but I will not go into a whole other podcast episode of my curiosities right now. Okay. How do you know when you know?
I always shift know into feel. So for me, it's literally that, like, I feel when I feel. Mm. So if I want to know something, I have to feel it first. And then it's actually part of me.
Mm. I love that. I don't know that you drink coffee based on what I've seen of your Instagram, but what is your go-to coffee shop order?
I have a go-to coffee shop order. And if I'm needing a bit of a charge, it's a London Fog, you know, or like an Earl Grey with like oat milk, you know, foamed into it. And if it's like a typical day, it's like a peppermint or a chamomile latte.
Mm. There's this place up the street from my house. It's a random Dutch restaurant and they have an Amsterdam Fog and they've made it with spirulina.
Ooh.
It is shockingly delicious. Like, I don't know. I probably should just try to recreate it at home, but it's so fucking good.
I love that.
I don't often go there because it's like not the place. It's not my place.
Yeah, yeah.
But hearing you say London Fog, I was like, I need to get over there to that Dutch place. Awesome. Well, what does grace mean to you?
Grace for me means when something comes through me that creates clarity. Mm-hmm. Like when I discovered music, it was a moment of grace where I never thought I'm going to go play music. It just kind of came through and it created a way for me to connect to myself when I didn't know how to. Mm. And that was like a moment of grace.
I love that. Kind of like surprise and delight and wonder from the universe.
Yes. Yes. Without me taking any credit for it.
Yeah. Before I ask you the last question, I'm genuinely curious if you know your sun, moon, rising.
I do.
Would you share them with me?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
I'm a Virgo sun. I'm a Leo rising and a Cancer moon.
Amazing. I'm also a Virgo sun.
Oh, cool.
Virgo, Leo rising, Cancer moon. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Last question is, what do you want?
I mean, I'm not just saying this, but this moment right here, it's like feels so gooey. So I feel satisfied.
I love that. Yay. Well, please share with us where you want people to go to find your work. Like, where would you like to connect with people?
Yeah, I think the best ways are through my website, which is holisticlifenavigation.com, and on Instagram, the same name, holisticlifenavigation.com. I teach a course throughout the year. I teach 4 courses a year, and you can find everything about that on my website. And Instagram, I offer a lot of kind of free resources and exercises to do this work, even if you can't afford to pay for it or work with a therapist.
Awesome. And people are often asking me how they can find a somatic practitioner, because I speak about my somatic practitioner like a lot, very much sing their praises. And do you take clients, or is your program the way to get the best work with you?
Yeah. So I've had a full-time private practice for a while, and this year we're transitioning to group work. So the way it works now is you can take the 6-week program, and then there's another ongoing program. Then after that, you can join the membership. And so we meet like once or twice a week. We do a lot of different work throughout the month, and that's how people work with me now. Mm-hmm. But if someone does want one-on-one work, if you go to traumahealing.org, that's the institute I studied with, there's an amazing find a practitioner directory there. And it's global, it's international. So different culture, different languages, different specifications of what you're working with. It's a great place to just click, find somebody, and you can go on Zoom and start doing somatic work right away. So I recommend that.
I love knowing that. And also I have a sweet spot for groups. I love my one-on-one clients, but facilitating groups, I find there's something so special about getting to relate to people as they're relating to other people, and different things come up in a group context that can, I believe, allow for accelerated breakthroughs, accelerated healing, because it's not just a contained relationship, which serves a purpose, but groups just feel very expansive. So it's fun to hear you working in this way through groups.
I couldn't agree more. I think especially with trauma work and somatic trauma work, the co-regulation you get with a group dynamic, most of our trauma comes from not being connected. Mm-hmm. So to actually have a place to connect with this language is like so settling for many bodies. Yeah. So I love group work. It's just brilliant.
Awesome. Anything you want to say before we wrap up?
This has been so amazing. You know, it's nice. It's nice, when I'm interviewed by a bunch of different people and I get to feel like different things with each person, you have a beautiful depth and space, and it felt really easy to talk to you. And I appreciate that.
Thank you. I agree. I knew this was going to be fun because I've listened to your podcast. I've been really looking forward to this, and I appreciate you saying yes. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for tuning in to Everything Belongs. With the number of podcasts and content online and a very full life, I know the value of your attention, and I'm so grateful for every minute you spend listening to this show and having these conversations reverberate through your home, your car, and in your life. Thank you so much. If you loved this episode, please subscribe and leave me a 5-star review on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app so others might find this podcast. You can find the show notes for every episode on my website and find more out about today's guest by going to madisonmorrigan.com/podcast. And if you want to find a place to get started with my coaching work, the best place to do so is to download the Call Your Energy Back practice. It is a free journal guide and short hypnotic meditation to help you get into a daily routine of connecting to yourself, so that you can take up all of your rightful space, embody your wholeness, and live with the power that comes when you really belong to yourself. You can go to madisonmorrigan.com/energy-back to download it right now. This meditation uses binaural beats, the brilliance of your subconscious mind, and powerful coaching questions to release the energy and emotions of other people, to generate a field of protection all around you, and will leave you feeling full of your true self, powerful, worthy, and whole. Now, if you're not already, please come and hang with me over on Instagram, DM me, and let me know your favorite part of this episode. And until next time, remember that curiosity can be a portal to a life where everything belongs.